This morning, Governor Rauner made it official. He's making another run for office. We'll bring you his announcement and a preview of the upcoming veto session. Plus, Illinois residents can buy health insurance next year through Get Covered Illinois starting November 1st. With all the breaking news around healthcare, people like Barbara Otto have been pushing even harder to make sure patients have the information they need.
This year, we've had to really double down on getting out the word, especially in downstate Illinois. The Trump administration has not only shortened the enrollment period, but they've really cut funding.
And we give you some tips this pumpkin season.
You don't want to carve your pumpkin too soon. If you carve it right away, it's going to quickly fail. You'd want to carve them not more than 2 or 3 days before to keep them looking good for the trick-or-treaters coming by.
Stay with us. All of that coming up this hour on the 21st. But first, the latest news. Welcome to the 21st on this very soggy Monday morning. I hope everyone's staying dry out there. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The future of the Affordable Care Act hung in the balance all summer as Republicans in Congress tried to agree on a bill that would repeal the law. There was the American Health Care Act and the Better Care Reconciliation Act, then Graham Cassidy. All of those bills failed to pass. In the White House, the Trump administration has been also chipping away at parts of the law. Earlier this month, President Trump made it easier for employers to stop covering birth control as part of their health plans and decided to stop paying subsidies that make it easier for lower-income Americans to afford health insurance. With all of this unpredictable news, it can be easy to forget you actually can still buy health insurance for next year on the online marketplace. Here, it's known as Get Covered Illinois. The time to start up actually starts next Wednesday, November 1st. So what questions do you have if you want to sign up for health insurance for next year? We've got a couple of folks here to answer them. You can also, as always, give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21STShow. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. Kristen Schorsch is a healthcare reporter with Crain's Chicago Business. She's helped us understand lots of nuances of healthcare as we've gone through all of these changes this year. She's on the line from Chicago, as well as Barbara Otto, who's the CEO of Smart Policy Works. They're a Chicago-based nonprofit that helps consumers and small businesses all across the state understand healthcare. Kristen, Barbara, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Barbara, your organization has done a lot of outreach work, especially this year, and I want to get to that in a minute. But first, you mentioned to one of our producers last week that one of the biggest misconceptions around the online marketplace is that most people don't even think they're eligible. So I think maybe we should start with asking who exactly is eligible to buy health insurance through Get Covered Illinois.
Well, good morning, and thank you for doing this really important show. If you and your family are in a household with income above roughly, and again, I don't want to give big numbers, but roughly above $16,000, $17,000, your employer does not offer coverage, or maybe you are working multiple jobs, you are eligible for coverage through Get Covered Illinois. And one sure way to find out whether you're eligible or not is once you get online, they ask you a series of questions, and they'll tell you pretty quickly whether you're eligible and direct you to which plan is best for you, whether it's applying for maybe the ACA expansion program, which is really Medicaid for adults, or whether it's going through the portal and getting a qualified health plan.
What other big misconceptions are out there right now that you're seeing, Barbara, about healthcare?
A lot of what I'm hearing is from people who work for small businesses, probably just above that working poor threshold, families saying, you know, I thought the ACA was really just for poor people. You know, I didn't realize that I could apply for coverage and I might even get help. So a lot of what we've been doing is communicating through small businesses, through chambers of commerce, working with institutions like public libraries, and working to get out information about those individuals who are really paid on the ground to help people navigate this program. You know, we have something called the Illinois Coalition on Healthcare Access. And we've been making sure that their information has been getting out, because you can contact them and find someone in your community who can help you navigate these programs. We've also been referring people to the ACA Consumer Advocacy Group. This is a group that came out of the Land of Lincoln dissolution. That's when a health plan in the state of Illinois went under, and consumers banded together to help each other navigate. So there are two really great sources that are kind of boots on the ground that are available to help people.
Right. And so I think there's two parts of this, right? There's Illinois and changes that have happened in Illinois with insurers. And then there's the federal piece of this. Kristen, I think most people can be forgiven, frankly, for not knowing what's going on, because there's just been so many changes and attempts, successful and not, in terms of healthcare and ACA. Kristen, I'm thinking about last Monday, we started the program about talking about how President Trump had decided to stop paying subsidies that help lower income Americans get health coverage. On Wednesday, Senators Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray said they had agreed on a plan to fund those subsidies for 2 years, at least in principle. Can we just start with the subsidies? Is there any do we have any clarity on whether that's going to get funded or not?
Yeah, well, I thought I would back up to explain this a bit, because, right,
sure,
it's very complex. It's very confusing, even for the most nuanced experts. I've spent a lot of time trying to understand this myself to be able to break it down. So essentially, the way that people who buy health insurance on the exchanges, they pick a plan based on a metallic level, gold, silver, bronze. And I'm explaining this so I can walk you through what Illinois has done to get around this lack of subsidies. So to make these plans cheaper, people can qualify for financial aid in two ways. So one is they get a tax credit, which lowers their monthly premium costs. And two is that they can qualify for a cost-sharing subsidy, which are these subsidies that are going away. So this lowers your out-of-pocket costs, like deductibles and your co-pays. So people who qualify for a cost-sharing subsidy only can use it to buy a silver plan. And this is important to understand why Illinois did what it did. At the same time, the tax credit is going to lower your monthly premium. So since the federal government helps cover the premium cost through this tax credit, as those premium costs rise, so do the tax credits to match that increase. So in essence, what Illinois did is they had insurers, because Illinois basically said, look, we think that these tax credits – the cost-sharing subsidies are likely going to go away. The president's been talking about this for quite a time, so let's just bake that into the rates that you're proposing to sell on the exchange in Illinois in 2018. So basically what the insurers here have done is add a 15% surcharge on average to the monthly premiums of the silver plans. So this basically bounces that extra tab to the federal government. This also shields people who are buying.
Sorry, Kristen, can I stop you for a second? That bounces the tab to the federal government or to people who are paying for the silver plan?
Right. So by essentially what they call loading the surcharge to the silver plans, because at the same time, people who qualify for a cost-sharing subsidy are the poorest of the poor who are buying on the exchange. Mm-hmm. So they will have, also along that subsidy, they'll have the tax credit to cover their monthly premiums. So by increasing adding the surcharge to the premiums on the silver plan, because those premiums are going up, the federal government, you know, will cover that increase. So essentially, that shifts the average 15% surcharge to the federal government. So people who are buying silver and get us and qualify for a subsidy, they will not feel that. They will not be paying that extra
surcharge. I see. Okay.
And neither will people who buy a gold plan or a bronze plan. And so that's what the state of Illinois and more than two dozen other states have done to essentially shield people from that extra cost. At the same time, though, you know, when the insurers were looking at what is health care going to cost, what are rates going to look like in 2018, so this was baked into those costs, but they are increasing cost quite a bit. On average for consumers, it's going to be about a 43% increase depending on what kind of plan you buy.
Okay. We're talking about health care, about the exchanges, about Get Covered Illinois. Enrollment starts next Wednesday for the year. Helping us explain that, we were just listening to Kristen Shore. She's a healthcare reporter with Crane Chicago Business. Also on the line with us is Barbara Otto. She's CEO of Smart Policy Works. We had a question on Twitter. Barbara, Kristen, I'm not sure who is best able to answer this. Either one of you jump in. Emma was asking what the impact of the healthcare.gov website maintenance will be on folks. Barbara, you had mentioned a couple other places where people could go for help. Can you answer that?
Well, just to make sure I understand the question, what will the impact be of basically the administration's, the Trump administration's sort of cutting back on supporting the website and
Correct.
Investing
mm-hmm.
in community? Yeah. Well, in Illinois, we have the opportunity to go to ilcha.org/help. You can go online. You can find people in your community. Some of this work is being funded still by the Trump administration. We were greatly reduced in our funding this year, which means that it's going to be really hard to have boots on the ground downstate. But we've had a lot of community-based foundations, a lot of community-based organizations like and institutions like public libraries. We've had a lot of health insurance brokers step up to the plate and offer to help people, a lot of healthcare providers wanting to make sure that people are getting their help. So you can go online to find out more information. There's also a Facebook page called ACA Consumer Advocacy. And again, these are people to people trying to connect people with the best, most accurate information on how to get help to navigate these programs. One last thing I'll say about picking a health plan, and yes, there are different metal tiers. You hear a lot about gold, silver, bronze. I would tell consumers to take a look at those gold plans. Oftentimes people think those gold plans are going to be unaffordable, but this year you may want to look at the difference in rates between silver and gold, and the gold plan may be a better option for you. Given that the rates were really baked into the silver plan, and you may get good coverage and at a similar price, if not better price, than some of the silver plans.
And then why wouldn't you just pick bronze as the cheapest plan? Is that because the deductibles are the highest?
Oftentimes the deductibles are the highest. You may have a low, and this is the thing about purchasing insurance that I think a lot of consumers are still learning. A low premium usually means you're paying more either in your deductible, which you have to, a deductible, just as a reminder to everybody, you have to pay out of pocket to a certain point before the health plan kicks in and starts helping you pay for your coverage. So in the bronze plans, you may have a lower premium, but you also are going to have a higher deductible. And you also need to look very closely in some of those bronze plans to make sure that your physician is a part of the bronze plan, or to make sure that the hospital that your physician has the ability to practice in is in that health plan. A lot of people just look at premium costs and don't look at the network and don't look at the health providers that are available.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, when we think about in terms of stability and affordability and quality of health coverage, how do you think Illinois' online marketplace is looking compared to other states this year? You've talked about the increase certainly that we've seen. That's happening, I imagine, across the country.
Yeah, people are seeing double-digit increases across the board. A lot of that is due to insurers, you know, not knowing what the president was going to do in terms of taking away the cost-sharing subsidies, because essentially the insurers, you know, they lower the deductibles and the co-pays, and to do that, then the federal government essentially reimburses them. So because of that uncertainty, insurers baked into the rates for enrollment that starts on November 1, these higher costs. I also wanted to add to your previous question, just in terms of what shoppers should be looking for enrollment. Every Sunday during enrollment season, which is from November 1 to December 15th, just a reminder that healthcare.gov, which is a federal portal that Illinois and about three dozen other states use where people buy insurance, that's going to be shut down for 12 hours, almost nearly every Sunday.
Right. I think that was a little bit right what Emma's tweet was at also. So that's shut down every Sunday. What does that mean? Does that mean essentially, Kristen, what does that mean in terms of you won't have access?
Right. I mean, basically, that means that you're going to have, you know, for people who are working Monday through Friday, you might not have time during the day to really check out your options. You should be shopping early, and you should be looking, looking at, like Barbara said, looking at your networks to make sure the doctors and hospitals that you like to go to are within those networks, because you might just only have Saturday, you know, through this enrollment period to look at the options, really understand them. Basically, it's taking away one of the busiest days, I would think, to be able to buy insurance on the exchange.
And that's the enrollment period begins next Wednesday, goes through December 15th. And when people are going to kind of the most common website, which is healthcare.gov, just a reminder for everybody, that's not going to be available on Sunday, as you've said.
Pretty much nearly every Sunday, correct.
Right. Kristen, right. You know, are there any other changes you think are likely to happen that patients should be aware of as they're looking through health plans? Or at this point, nothing will affect what's going to happen for what people sign up for the rest of the year?
Well, I mean, essentially, I think that people need to, like I mentioned, you know, shop early and really go through the plans and perhaps sit down with a navigator to try and understand what their options are. Like Barbara mentioned, it's important to make sure that whatever plan you're picking, you understand which doctors you can see, which hospitals are going to be in that network, and how much you're going to have to pay in terms of your monthly premiums and then those out-of-pocket costs. Because, right, depending on the plan you pick, they could be pretty pricey.
Okay, I guess that wraps up our conversation with Barbara and with Kristen. Thanks so much for being with us. Stay tuned. We're going to continue talking about Illinois politics coming up. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Coveting Nature, Art, Collecting, and Natural History in Early Modern Europe, an exhibition of botanical artwork from U of I collections. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you had any doubts this morning, Governor Rauner put those to rest. He's officially running for a second term. He made that announcement via a video ad featuring a trip around the state on his beloved Harley. On Mondays, we like to talk about Illinois politics. We're going to talk about that race, the billions of dollars being spent on the Democratic side. We're going to see how much is going to be spent as well on the Republican side. Lawmakers are returning to Springfield tomorrow for the veto session. With me to dig into this political season are Joe Bustos. He's a reporter with the Belleville News Democrat. And on the line from the State House, where he's a State House correspondent for IPR, is Brian Mackey. Brian, Joe, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Hello, Nyla.
Brian, lawmakers are back in Springfield tomorrow for the veto session. One of the bills on the docket is the Debt Transparency Act. Governor Bruce Rauner has already vetoed this legislation that Democratic Comptroller Susana Mendoza says would help the state manage overdue bills. Can you explain what this bill is about?
Yeah, this bill is about the backlog. The way Illinois government, one of the ways Illinois government stayed functional and operational over the last couple of years when there was a two-year-plus budget impasse is by not paying its bills for vendors. This is everyone from people who go and sit with elderly and disabled people and do their laundry with them and shopping for them to the people who supply the hot dog spice for the Illinois prison system, right? So there's many, many billions of dollars that racked up. Late last week, it was $16.5 billion that we owed these people. But that number fluctuates a lot. And what the controller says is that we don't really have a good definitive sense of how much money we owe at any one time because the administration really only has to report on how much money it owes vendors once a year. And so she wants to make that requirement monthly. And, you know, what we'd see every now and then is the backlog would look like it would be getting better. It would get down to $14 billion maybe, as an example, and then jump up by $1 billion because the administration would release a huge pile of bills that it had been kind of sitting on. This would attempt to prevent that from happening in the future and just give us a more clear picture of what our current debt level is.
Right. And Joe, do you think, Governor, do you have a sense of why Governor Rauner vetoed this? Did he just say he thought this was a waste of money to be tracking this?
I believe there was some thought that this is like a micromanaging by the comptroller's office over state agencies. And I think one legislator I spoke to mentioned that they would have to be creating reports, and he called it an unfunded mandate on these agencies. So they view it as a micromanaging. I know it took, from my understanding, it took a governor up until the very end to veto it before sending it back to the General Assembly. So, I believe Suzanne Mendoza was actually in our office just a few minutes ago, and she's very confident that there are the votes to override this coming week.
All right. So we'll see if there's an override on that. Brian, let me ask you, Attorney General Lisa Madigan is also calling for an override of Governor Rauner's veto of the student loan bill of rights. Can you tell us a little bit about this? This would provide assistance to student borrowers and their families that are trying to navigate the fairly complex college loan system.
Yeah, I mean, it does a couple of things. It requires loan servicers to, process payments properly and, require that they have specialists who can help borrowers who might be struggling to know what all of their repayment options are. This is, as you pointed out, there's a lot of people with student loan debt. I think the Attorney General cited something like 44 million people owing $1.4 trillion. She says, this is a sort of common sense thing. Of course, we have seen a lot of Democrats pick up this mantle. Senator Dick Durbin here in Illinois has been talking
about
student
mm-hmm.
doing action at the federal level. So this is yet another area where we're going to see Democrats attempting to go around the governor's veto this in the coming weeks.
Yeah, Brian, do we have any sense of how likely this override will be?
I don't actually have the vote totals for that off the top of my head to know. But, I think as we try and take a step back and look at, the governor has been very successful at preventing veto overrides in the past. I want to say there's really just until the budget impasse, which was obviously the biggest veto override of his career, there maybe had only been one or maybe just a handful of times when the legislature had successfully overridden one of his vetoes. And that's because he had done a great job of keeping the Republicans together. And even though the Senate Democrats have a veto-proof majority, at least for this year, and functionally, although they had a veto-proof majority, Democrats in the House for the first 2 years of the Rauner administration, the Democrats did not always stick together on that stuff. So the governor has been very successful at blocking overrides in the past with just a handful of exceptions up to this budget impasse. But he's also really angered members of his own party with some recent decisions to sign a pro-abortion piece of legislation.
Right, that's HB 40.
Right, and another pro-immigrant piece of legislation that the governor says, look, law enforcement says this was okay, but a lot of conservatives are decrying it as making Illinois a quote-unquote sanctuary state. So will the Republicans stick with him on more mundane everyday topics like debt transparency, like student loan protections? That's going to be one of the big political questions overhanging this veto session.
Yeah, Brian, go ahead, Joe. Go ahead.
I think one of the interesting parts about it is like how many Republican legislators are leaving after this term, and whether they now see like they may not have to stick with Governor Rauner for any kind of reelection help. So that I think that might play a role into what happens this coming week.
Right. Of course, that also because all of that leads sort of back to money, right? And to Brian, I wonder if you can address a little Republicans. Lawmakers' sort of reluctance to challenge Governor Rauner because he's been pretty vocal about the fact that if you challenge him, he's going to fund opponents against you.
Well, and he's put the proof out there, right? State Senator Sam McCann knows firsthand what happens if you cross the governor on one of his, top priorities. There was a bill that had to do with union negotiations here in the state a couple of years ago, and State Senator Sam McCann, who's a Republican from the Springfield area and some of the rural areas south of Springfield, decided to go against the governor's wishes because he says he was doing what his constituents wanted. He has state employees in his district and felt that that this bill was the right thing for them. This was something pushed by AFSCME, the biggest labor union in state government, and it would have kind of short-circuited union negotiations if they came to an impasse, which they weren't at the time, but they actually have since then, and it would have sent it to arbitration. That bill ultimately failed, but not because Senator Sam McCann voted against it. He actually voted for it, drawing the governor's ire, and the governor went and actively campaigned with a primary opponent against him. McCann ultimately won that primary, and he won re-election, but he definitely had a rougher go of it than he otherwise might have. So the governor has put his money where his mouth is, and he has also dangled, as you pointed out, tens of millions of dollars in his own campaign fund and contributed to millions and millions to other candidates in the state Republican Party. So he has held people in line with that. But as you said, things have changed now. There have been some other bills passed, and there are a lot of lame ducks in the legislature.
Yeah, that's IPR's Brian Mackey. Joe Bustos is with us as well. He's with the Belleville News Democrat. Brian, you mentioned primary opponents for Sam McCann, and I can't help but think now of whether or not Governor Rauner will be facing primary opponents. This morning, he officially announced via YouTube that he's going to be running again for governor. He hops on his Harley to take us on a campaign ride. Let's take listen to a little bit of it.
Together, we've taken on the toughest fights. Property taxes, education, criminal justice, ethics. We've won some, and we've lost some. But nothing worthwhile is ever easy. Illinois still needs property tax relief, real term limits, and a budget that won't bankrupt or break us.
So it's a clip from the governor's new campaign video. Brian, let me start with you. The governor is still, as you listen to that, it's sort of the same things he's been saying all along, right? He still wants term limits. He still wants property tax. I wonder what your reaction was when you were sort of looking at that this morning and kind of analyzing it.
I mean, it's a striking video. It's very slickly produced. It's beautiful cinematography, what is the term, disaster, people would go to Detroit and take pictures of abandoned factories and boiled up buildings. I can't think of
it's like ruined
disaster
porn.
Tourism or something like that. Yeah, there you go. So, I mean, it has that feel to it. I've seen online someone was comparing it to that the car commercials that came out of it. Was during the Super Bowl a couple years ago of Detroit.
Right, Detroit
this is America.
Ones. Yeah.
This is Detroit. Yeah. So, I mean, boy, that Illinois sure does look like
that. Yeah, there's
kind of
almost even like the track is a little like Eminem, right? Like what's sort of like.
Yeah. There's that sort of a guitar riff that makes you think of that. And, as you said, it's the same message we've heard for a long time. Governor Rauner has positioned himself as the outsider. And that is what he and his team believe the political path to victory is. It's not, they think the most salient thing in American politics right now is not Democrat or Republican, conservative or liberal. They think it's insider versus outsider. And even though he has been governor for two and a half years now, going on 3 years, he is still portraying himself as the outsider fighting the good fight and hoping to use that to propel himself to reelection.
Joe, what about you? I wonder what your thoughts were when you saw the video and also where we're looking at in terms of whether or not he will have a primary candidate who will face him.
You stole my thunder when you brought up Eminem. I was just watching it with a coworker again, and we heard that track.
It's a little lose myself, right? Yeah.
Yeah, literally, is he going to start rapping here? It was what I was hoping for. I don't know if we'll see a a primary challenge. I know there was people who were talking about whether Kyle McCarter would want to jump in, but he's kind of shied away from that. He's still waiting to see if he's going to be a
ambassador, right?
Ambassador to Kenya. So I know there was some talk about Representative Ives jumping in, but ultimately, if you're going to challenge Governor Rauner in a primary, you're going to have to go up against all the money that he has in his campaign account, which is, what, $71 million right now, or last reported, and he could write himself a check if he needs to, and he'll buy up all the airtime that he needs to. So that's what you would go up against when challenging Governor Rauner in a primary.
Right, and I think I can't help but recall, I don't know if you all saw the Economist article calling he basically said, like, do you have to be a bajillionaire to run for office? And use Illinois as an example. I think they called it the yacht primary between bajillionaires. I know there was a Quad City Times editorial saying only billionaires can run for governor. Brian, I mean, I wonder what you make of that.
I mean, I don't think that's necessarily true. As long as you have plenty of other people willing to donate money. I mean, Illinois, there is a finite amount of money you can actually spend on this. There's only so many TV ad slots, and if you completely take over the airwaves, people sort of tune out. So as long as you are at least equally funded on both sides, you can, you know, the other side can be competitive. I mean, Governor Rauner spent 2-1 in his election victory in 2014, something like $60 million, very rough figures here, but $60 million to Governor Pat Quinn's $30 million back in 2014. And he only won by about 5 percentage points. So, I mean, the money makes a difference, and it certainly helps with viability, but ultimately it takes more than money. You actually have to convince people who actually do the voting to turn up and pull the lever for you. And so I guess we don't really have levers anymore. Touch the screen or fill in the bubble, whatever it is in your area anymore.
Right. And Joe, right. And when we look on the Democratic side, right, Joe, I mean, when we're looking at fundraising, actually, Daniel Biss has done a little bit better in fundraising than Chris Kennedy versus, of course, the other, I don't know if bajillionaire is the accurate term for J.B. Pritzker, but the other very wealthy person in the race.
Yeah, but Amaya Pawar was doing relatively well. He had raised $800,000 through 10 months on the campaign trail, but he still had to tap out when he saw the amount of money that J.B. Pritzker was throwing in, how much money Chris Kennedy was able to write himself. So there is a little bit of that. JB's already on the air buying up advertising, and I probably see at least one JB Pritzker ad a day, either on my Facebook feed or on my television. So you're battling against someone who could buy up the airtime. Now, whether people tune it out or they just don't want to see this early, that's a perfectly legitimate point. But it'd be interesting to see when someone comes out with the next poll, see if J.B. Pritzker has pulled ahead of Chris Kennedy in those polls.
Let's get back to, we just have a minute or two left, and I just want to get back to the veto session just very briefly. Joe, can I just ask you about gun control? Because this is the first time state lawmakers have met since the Las Vegas shooting. Is there anything that's going to be coming up in the veto session that may be addressing this?
There are a couple bills that are coming up. They're going to be in, I believe, the Judiciary Committee. One by Scott, from Representative Scott Drury, who's running for Attorney General, talking about banning bump stocks. And I think there's one that also bans assault rifles.
And what are bump stocks?
Bump stocks, they make semi-automatic rifles, make them fire like an automatic rifle, so makes it easier to continuously shoot at people or shoot at a target.
Mm. Okay.
And it's what the Las Vegas shooter apparently used when he carried out his attack at the country music festival.
Yeah, Brian, we've got a minute left.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's a couple of different approaches, as you said. Drury has the trigger the bump stock ban. There's another one that's just focused on trigger modification devices and explosive construction parts. But then there's another bill that is this full-on assault weapons. At least it bans the future sale of assault weapons, 50 caliber weapons, large capacity magazines. I think that those sort of things have long been a dream of gun control advocates in Illinois, but they were a bit of a further reach. I think it's also interesting that in that same committee, the Judiciary Committee that, Joe was referencing. There are a couple of resolutions that have been put up there from a Republican, one denouncing domestic terrorism, including bigoted ideologies, and one calling on Congress to have universal concealed carry.
Lots of to be handled in the veto session. We'll hear more from Brian Mackey on that. I want to thank Joe Bustos as well for joining us. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Each year, the great pumpkin rises out of the pumpkin patch that he thinks is the most sincere. He's got to pick this one. He's got to. I don't see how a pumpkin patch can be more sincere than this one.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and that is a scene from It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, something that always pops up this time of year because we're right in the thick of pumpkin season. As you've probably noticed by all the pumpkin spice offerings, whether it's at your local coffee shop or grocery store or the jack-o'-lanterns lighting up your neighborhood, pumpkins are an especially big deal for us in Illinois because we're the top pumpkin-producing state in the country. Unusually heavy rainfall here all but decimated crops 2 years ago, which contributed to a nationwide pumpkin shortage. Illinois farmers fared much better last year, and 2017 has been looking pretty good as well. Joining us more to talk about pumpkins is Rachel Coventry, somebody who's grown up and worked around all shapes and sizes of pumpkins her entire life. She's on the line from Champaign County, from Curtis Orchard in Savoy. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
So you grew up around and in pumpkin patches, correct?
That is correct. I actually, one of my first jobs was hoeing our pumpkin patch. I was probably 7 or 8 years old out there helping my dad and my siblings.
And what does that entail? Was that weeds, basically, or what were you doing?
Weed control. Okay. Mm-hmm. And some thinning, because if you have too many pumpkin plants too close together, then they start to crowd each other, and you're not going to get a good production of nice-sized pumpkins. So the weeds are a big deal, obviously, because they will crowd out the plants and choke the plants, and you're not going to have much of a crop, just like you would in your home garden want to kill the weeds. And one of the ways we do that is go out there and manually pull and chop all the weeds down.
Wow. So that's a lot of work, I imagine. Can you let our listeners know how big you all are, your operations, and how many pumpkins you guys generally tend to produce every year?
Yes, we are an 80-acre farm. However, about, depending on the year, between 16 and 20 acres are put into pumpkin production. And that is where we get most of our pumpkins grow right there, and we harvest them and bring them up front. We have several different varieties also, not just the classic orange one like everybody sees. So we also have about 20 acres of apples in that mix of property.
Mm-hmm. So let's, for pumpkins, not just the classic orange pumpkin, people might not know this, but the kinds of pumpkins we carve aren't the same kind of pumpkins that we put in pies, right?
That's correct. The ones that they bake for the what you see, the Libby, the classic ones, and of course their nickname Libby pumpkins, are called often called Dickinson Field. It's a tan buckskin variety, and it has a real deep orange flesh that's very sweet compared to your classic jack-o'-lantern. If you were to cook that down, it would not have much flavor at all.
And how big are those, the Libby ones?
Oh, they can range in size from 10 pounds to 30, 40 pounds. Just depends on when you pick them.
And you guys have all kinds of pumpkins, not just orange ones, but white pumpkins and giant pumpkins,
white.
Even blue pumpkins?
Yeah, blue. They're called Jardales. They're kind of a bluish green, kind of a, you know, not a bright blue, not a royal blue, but definitely a very unique color. And those are really good for eating as well. The inside is actually a deep orange
Oh, so it's not blue on the it's not like
no,
purple
potatoes.
No, it's
not blue on the inside. Okay. And neither are the pink ones. I know those are very popular. They've got these ones that look like they have packing peanuts stuck all over the outside of them. And those actually have a concentration of sugar. That's what causes that packing peanut look. And those are delicious for eating as well.
So we started this conversation. I mentioned the really tough season that farmers had a couple of years ago. Things were not so bad this year. How have you all fared this year?
Yeah, this year has been a fantastic one for pumpkins. It's been dry. I know we need some rain, but overall not too much rain because that really causes the powdery mildew to flourish and other bacterial diseases just will wipe out your crop.
Right, that's what happened 3 years ago, right?
Yes, yes. But this year, no, it's been fantastic. We've got a lot of pumpkins out in the patch. And, you know, the farther back you go, people tend to pick whatever's closest, what they find right up near the property. And but if you go to the back, boy, you'll find loads more. And we like to mix our seeds somewhat, so you'll maybe find a patch of a bunch of blue ones, and then you'll go over here and you'll find the white and the pink together, and you'll find some orange ones, and you'll maybe find some squash or just weird things out there, which is probably the most fun with going to an actual patch, is you're seeing everything as it's growing and not just what the farmer put in place and lined up.
I wonder, what are the ideal conditions for growing pumpkins?
Well, you need lots of sunshine, warm sunshine, and good dry weather helps as well. You do need occasional rain, otherwise you're going to be looking at running some irrigation lines out there, because they obviously consume plenty of water to grow their fruit, all those pumpkins. You need the sunshine in order for pollinators to get into the pumpkin flowers. The honeybees and other pollinators, other insect pollinators, don't tend to fly as much if you're going to have rainy, cloudy conditions. At least honeybees, they use the sun to navigate, so they won't tend to fly at all if it's cloudy, even if it's not necessarily raining.
Right. You're a beekeeper as well, correct?
I am. Mm-hmm.
So do bees play a role, I mean, in pollinating pumpkins?
They do. I would say they are not the preferred choice. I think the sugar content of their nectar is not as desirable to them, but honeybees, especially a good strong hive, tend to forage multiple different floral sources at a time. So you'll see honeybees on the clover, and they'll also be in the apple trees, and they'll also be in cherry trees, and some of them may also go to the pumpkins. It just depends what else is going on around them. But native pollinators we see a lot out there as well, because I think they're more drawn to it.
So speaking of pumpkins, what, by the way, how do you, what's sort of your biggest pumpkin, and how do you kind of coax the biggest pumpkin? Is that all water related?
Oh, you mean size-wise? I think the most popular.
Yes.
The it's a variety thing more than anything. You know, you have those Atlantic giants, and man, they're just, It's the variety. It's
how like big are those then? How big can those get?
Those can be 60, 70 pounds each.
Wow.
And there's even ones, prize winner is another big variety. We don't have tons of those, but because I think the market isn't as popular for those gigantic varieties, but they are sure fun to see. And I love seeing people lug in the biggest one they can find, and it's just, the kids just get a kick out of it to see one that weighs more than them.
Right. I was going to say it's bigger than them. So
yes.
I know a lot of people like baking pumpkin seeds that they get when they're carving jack-o'-lanterns. And we've heard the myth that the bigger the pumpkin, the fewer the seeds. Is there any truth to that?
I haven't seen that to be the case. I mean, I'm not sure what determines how many seeds are in each one. But I don't think, maybe they're saying like a reference, like percentage wise, like if you did the calculation of how heavy this pumpkin weighed and how many seeds you got from it, it doesn't necessarily correlate to more seeds, but maybe it's about the same amount of seeds.
Because
I've scooped a big pumpkin and there's been tons of seeds in there, and I've scooped out a little sugar pie and there's been, you know, much fewer than a big jack-o'-lantern.
So do you have a favorite variety of pumpkin, Rachel? We were talking about this before, and my favorite isn't actually a pumpkin. It's like the West Indian pumpkin or winter squash. I think it's like a calabaza. I don't think it's technically a pumpkin. I think it's probably more of a squash. I wonder what your favorite variety.
Oh, what one is that? Is it turban or something?
So it's a West Indian pumpkin. It's pretty small. I think the Spanish name is calabaza. It's hard to find, I think. I grew up with it in Florida. I think in tropical climates it grows pretty well. And it's a really good cooking pumpkin. So it's kind of the pumpkin.
Nice.
And I've actually only ever found them in Illinois in either Spanish or Asian grocery stores.
Oh, it's not something... like that little green one?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's a type of squash. And if I'm looking for one to carve, I like one that doesn't have too many bumps on it. It makes it easier to carve. But our most popular is called Mrs. Wrinkles, which is a great name, but it's a very classic one with the nice ridging on it. My favorite would be the Cinderella pumpkins, those squatty, vibrant, orange-red pumpkins. I think they're great, and especially when you stack them with the Jardales and the pink ones or the white ones, you make this nice tower of pumpkins, and it's a perfect fall decoration, and it looks beautiful, and it's inviting, and I like decorating the fall. Who doesn't want to see lots of pumpkins?
Rachel, speaking of Mrs. Wrinkle, I have a question for you about timing for when you're going to put your pumpkin out, because it is kind of sad when you see the jack-o'-lanterns that have kind of like collapsed inward because they've been out there too long. I imagine a lot of that has to probably do with weather and cold, and it's going to be different across. Mm-hmm. We have people listening from all sides of the state, but what's your advice for that?
Well, there's a couple of things you can do. I have actually sprayed my pumpkins with shellac to keep the squirrels from eating it. It helps to some extent. Squirrels, when they're desperate, they still love
it. They will eat the pumpkin with shellac on it?
Yes, they will chew right through it, because all they have to do is nibble a little bit to get to the seeds, and that's what they want, and then they don't even care. They'll just go right in, gut the pumpkin out, and then I'll have these seeds and pumpkins scattered all over. But again, it helps a little bit. I've also tried painting the pumpkins, and they have left those alone, which is good, because you don't want to carve your pumpkin too soon. If you carve it right away, it's going to quickly fail and not look good for Halloween. You'd want to carve them, you know, not more than 2 or 3 days before to keep them looking good for the trick-or-treaters coming by. But, you know, people want to carve them whenever they have time. So maybe come out and carve one, and then a couple weeks later carve another one and have options that way. Or you can also, another thing that can attack your pumpkin would be some kind of bacteria. So if you wash it down in a light bleach solution, you know, maybe just put a tablespoon of bleach in a bucket of water and then clean off all the dirt and scrub it down, that will help keep your pumpkin lasting longer, or your squash too. If you know it's going to freeze, bring the pumpkin inside or cover it or put it in your garage somewhere where it's not going to get that cold, because a frost will also cause your pumpkin to turn to mush. But you don't want it to get too warm, so if you keep it inside, it could also, kind of like your potatoes, you know, if you keep them inside, they start to sprout. It wouldn't sprout, but it would also cause it to decay quicker. So those are my advice for keeping it around a little longer. But if you wash it and you paint it and you keep it from getting eaten, your pumpkin can last till next year, actually.
Till next year?
Yes, we had them last for all the way to the following November. We had one that was painted, and it just sat on the shelf in the store, and it never rotted until the following year, which is
crazy. Wow. Okay. So Curtis Orchard is right by the University of Illinois. I imagine you can get a lot of college students. I know people drive from all over to come. Our producers are just talking about how far people will drive to get to a good pumpkin patch. So for folks in central Illinois, besides pumpkins, what else is going on at Curtis Orchard this time of year?
Yes, you're right. People have made it a fall tradition to visit us or any other orchard in the area or pumpkin patch. And we have a whole lineup of activities that people can enjoy, such as apple picking. We have giant inflatable slide, pony rides, air cannons where you can shoot at various evil Oz characters, because our theme is Wizard of Oz. We have a corn maze. We have a wagon ride. And new this year is a giant jump pad that's shaped like a jack-o'-lantern. And it's been a real hit this year.
What's a jump pad? What do you mean?
You've heard of a jumping pillow? It's or a bounce house.
Ah, okay.
Like a giant bounce house without sides. I mean, it's probably 10 times what a bounce house that you're thinking of.
Okay.
So it can fit a bunch of people. People just love to jump on it and run around and be silly and have a good time. And it's a good way to enjoy the outside, get some exercise, and listen to live music and eat kettle corn or caramel apples and apple donuts, of course. So there's something for everyone. That's what we've tried to do, look at different ages and what they would enjoy and really made it fun for the whole family.
Well, thanks for taking time for us into your busiest time of year. Rachel Coventry is a store manager and beekeeper at Curtis Orchard in Savoy, Illinois. Rachel, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Nyla. I really appreciate it, too.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.